Pharmacy Podcast Nation, and especially our community pharmacy owners. Do you ever feel like you're getting pushed to do more with less? There's a product out there I'd like you to take a look at. Doing more for your pharmacy and more for your patients is important. I'm talking about the Pen Needle UltiGuard Safe Pack. For the same copay for your patients as pen needles alone, the UltiGuard Safe Pack provides 100 premium pen needles and a sharps container all in one. When pharmacies dispense the Pen Needle UltiGuard Safe Pack, they see consistently higher revenue and higher margins. Check this product out today and let us know what you think. Go to www.UltiGuardSafePack/podcast. That's UltiGuardSafePack/podcast. You can get a free sample pack on the website. Thanks for all you do as frontline healthcare providers, and thank you for listening to the Pharmacy Podcast.
Listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network. Since 2009, the Pharmacy Podcast Network has led the podcasting space for the pharmacy industry. This network of pharmacists and pharmacy technicians leads the podcasting charts with more than 2 million downloads, 40 different stations, and new episodes every week. The Pharmacy Podcast Network is the number one podcast for the pharmacy professional. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, and all your favorite podcast players. Join the Pharmacy Podcast Nation today.
Pharmacy Podcast Nation, this is Todd Urey, founder of the Pharmacy Podcast. This is something extremely interesting to me today that we're bringing to you, and that's the environment side of our health and how that impacts population health, which is a buzzword right now that must mean outcomes. It must mean something that can be connected to pharmacists and research and in the world of pharmacogenomics and testing. How does a medication affect you and it doesn't affect me based on my DNA? And how does my environment affect me that might maybe not affecting someone else? And what does green have to do with anything? What does my tree, the trees that are around me, bushes that are around me, have to do with my health? I was fascinated in to get introduced to somebody who really understands this and is studying this, Dr. Theodore Smith, who's an associate professor with the Department of Pharmacology and Toxicology with this school of Louisville, U of L School of Medicine. Welcome to the Pharmacy Podcast, Dr. Smith.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You have opened up a can of worms that I'd like to dig into that is very meaningful. And I grew up in the country. We just, before recording, we said we're both southwestern Pennsylvanians and in the around the greater Pittsburgh area. And I grew up way up north from you in Zillian Opal, Pennsylvania, but lots of green up there, lots of country. And when I looked into your background and what you were studying and the department that you're leading, the University of Louisville named you the official to direct a center to overlook the research of how environment is impacting health. What an interesting topic. I want you to give our listeners an overview of yourself and the department that you're leading.
Sure. So, as you mentioned, we're in the School of Medicine at the University of Louisville. And, you know, our focus is really the environment's impact on health outcomes. And, you know, we're all very, very comfortable with thinking about the role our physiology plays, our genes and, you know, kind of what we're born with and how our bodies function, how our metabolism operates, all that, as if everything happens as a little, you know, kind of chemistry cooker inside a sack of skin, all by itself, right? And the truth of the matter is, we've always known for thousands of years, you know, that we are somehow a function of kind of our physiology and the place that we're, you know, placed, right? And the circumstances that we're placed within. And we do know that when those things are compatible, that, you know, generally speaking, good things happen, right? So there is an environment that we're all, you know, fit for, if you will. And then there are environments we may find ourselves in that we are not fit for. And when we don't have a fit between our physiology and our environment, one of the things that we get is disease. And it's particularly important in these times because we can see just how important it is, especially in the developed world. The thing that limits human lifespan is it's chronic disease, like heart disease, like autoimmune diseases. Like, I mean, these are diseases that we didn't used to die of as a species, and now these are the things that ultimately limit human life. And so, knowing this, that somehow our health outcomes are a combination of these two things, and these two things need to be harmonized, really then drives a whole big research agenda for us, which is how should we understand which parts of the environment are important to which parts of our physiology? You know, so it's a very wide-ranging research agenda. I won't go into the whole spiel right now, but I mean, just you can imagine our environment at least at three levels. There's the natural environment that we're part of, which is which part of the planet we're on, our latitude, our altitude, how much, you know, how long our days are, and all those kinds of things are in the physical environment. There's our social environment, which is all the things that people have done to sort of create the environments around us. So the built environment in cities, the nature of social networks and the way that culture plays a role, the way we cultivate food and all of those kinds of things fits in the social environment. And then our personal environments, so that two people growing up in the exact same household could have very different lives because they have some personal, you know, view, their own version of that environment, even though a lot of it is shared. Like, our genes are shared greatly as a species, but we each have different trajectories. And so this idea of the environment really needs to be deconstructed. And we have several large projects that are focused on pieces of that. And I know we're maybe talk today a little bit about the Green Heart Project in Louisville, which is just very much focused on something as simple as how much nature is in our cities and what role does that play as it relates to heart disease.
This is not new. This has been studied for quite some time. Out of the BBC had an entire portfolio of articles and research called The 100-Year Life. And there was a part of it called Gardening Could Be the Hobby that helps you live to being 100 plus. And they were talking about these blue zones that have certain factors in common, social support networks and daily exercise habits and this plant-based diet for starters, and in the richness of the soil in your fingertips and what that does to your skin. And that's fascinating. And what's so funny is how, you know, there's an aspect of science that moves forward and I feel like it pulls us away from nature. And then there's the other that is very altruistic and in coupling of nature. And this green belief is part of this research of your 120 plus person team that is really putting a ton of time and research and money into this. Please expand upon what you had just said about the what I'm going to call the green team.
Yeah, so the green team is working on a project we call the Green Heart Project. And, you know, just as you just said, there's a bunch of published literature out there going back for many decades that has demonstrated a correlation between health status and proximity to nature. And it's most specifically clearly articulated as proximity to green spaces, right? And so the good news about doing research like that is it actually relies on satellites that orbit the Earth that take essentially high-resolution images of how much greenness there is around all different parts of the world, and then you can back the population into those satellite images, and you can do work then at the country level, at the city level, and at smaller scales. And what we know to be true with over 120 peer-reviewed published studies at all these different levels of granularity is that there is a benefit to living near green spaces. And so, and it's a powerful benefit depending on which disease you look at. We look at cardiovascular disease, and so reduction in mortality is significant for cardiovascular disease for people who live within certain distances of green places. And I love how you brought up gardens, because what the literature will show you is that while there's no published dose response curve like we would expect in a good drug study, when you look at the different proximities that people have studied, it appears that the closer you get, you continue to get advantage statistically. So that means having a park down the street is good. Having having something right across the street from you, like a bunch of trees in your neighbor's yard, that's good. Having a garden right outside your window, that's really good. So it turns out it's on a big continuum. So if you live in the middle of a concrete jungle in a city and nature involves a commute, then you're probably in the worst situation statistically, right? And it only it gets better as you get closer persistently to nature. And so that's what we know from correlational studies. Here's the problem. Correlation is not causation. We all know this. This is a statistics 101 conversation. And so the fact that there are 120 or so peer-reviewed publications that show this advantage, it's met with a certain amount of appropriate skepticism, which is to say, I don't know, wealthy people tend to live in nice places with lots of greenery, and maybe poor people don't often, are in situations like that. And there's environmental justice issues and inequity issues in the world. And, so we know that it's complicated and it doesn't lend itself to a clean empirical understanding. And so we embarked on an ambitious gold standard approach to this, which is to do a controlled clinical trial. And that means we would need to introduce greenness in a controlled fashion to a population that has less greenness right now, and have another population that's not getting the drug, right? And we would study that group of people over a period of several years, and we would see whether the introduction of all of this greenness had a health benefit. And so our Green Heart Project in Louisville, Kentucky is in four neighborhoods where about 22,000 people live. We are planting 10,000 trees in those four neighborhoods. We have done a clinical baseline where we've done a full workup on folks for all of the cardiovascular biomarkers and cardiovascular status, a number of other things, psychosocial things, and as many other things as we think we could try to grab along the way. We're measuring air pollution. We did baseline air pollution in the area. And now we're about to plant all that stuff. And then we will come back and do a post-test and look at vascular, stiffness of the artery in the neck, which is a well-known marker for cardiovascular disease progression. It's the kind of thing that you can set your watch by, that your arteries will get harder as you get older. And if we see a reduction in the rate that the arteries are hardening, that would be promising if that were in that one group that got all that greenness. At the same time, we're measuring air pollution because, somebody is going to want an answer to the question, well, how did it work? Right. So it's one thing to say, when I put the trees in, I got this effect. It's another thing to have what we would think of as a mechanistic understanding. So think of all those great drug trials where, for the most part, there's also, a thesis of the mechanism that's at play. That the reason I'm giving you this statin is because I know it's going to affect this particular process, right, with lipids. Right. And then I go and I prove that I changed the lipid profile and I knew about the statins and I knew what it did with lipids. For us and for nature, one of the leading ideas is that these you know, trees and bushes are big air filters, and they're cleaning up the air. And so if we see a reduction in heart disease and a reduction in air pollution after planting all this stuff, we're one step closer to elucidating a mechanism, if you will. Now, if we see people getting healthier without any change in air pollution, then we're stuck with a new problem, which is what else might be going on, right? We know that vegetation emits biogenic compounds. So maybe the trees and bushes themselves are producing some kind of chemistry that we've never really studied before. And so we would have the, you know, the beginnings of a platform to do that kind of work.
Well, I'm reading also about the Green Heart Project, which is extended throughout the country. And there are a group of students that were engaged by the Green Heart Project in Charleston County School District, where eight of them in Charleston County, South Carolina, and the eight of them participated in this this planting of trees and gardens, and they call it urban farming. And it's fascinating that this is spreading throughout the country, and I'm sure it's something that could engage young people and even, you know, high schoolers per se, if not even you know, I think of my own 8-year-old and getting involved and really learning about what nature does for you from a nutritional perspective, but also just the surroundings that you're within. And I'm lucky enough, I live in the country, but I don't really leverage gardening as probably as much as I should. And when you were talking, I was thinking of, you know, a controlled environment where they could see seniors or young people or participants, yep, really, you know, engaging together in growing and gardening and planting. So that's fascinating, Dr. Smith.
Yeah, no, we think this is very much the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there are many directions to take work like this. We have what we call a platform of ancillary studies that go on around the Green Heart Project. And, you know, for example, you know, perhaps the reason that all of this nature in cities has a health benefit is because we're getting closer to returning to a kind of circadian rhythm that our physiology is looking for. So maybe the light cycle in a city, you know, which is highly artificial in most cities, begins to get mitigated as you have this kind of vegetation around, right? So if you think about, you know, you think about light pollution, all this, we've extended daylight in cities, right? That extension of daylight has health consequences, right? Our bodies are not used to having days artificially extended. So we know that nature could play some role in restoring us. I like to think of it as to our ecology, right? And so, you know, think of us as all in the little animal in the terrarium. My question for you is, what terrarium did they put you in? And does it have enough stuff in it to support a healthy life for you? And I think from our perspective, you know, you can take this in all sorts of, we can look at noise. You know, we can look at, obviously we can look at air quality. We can look at aesthetics, right? And just, you know, whether these are pleasing environments to you, whether they're calming to you. I mean, there's a lot of dimensions to the terrarium. So if we could sort of ground ourselves in what ecology am I in, and is it sufficient for me to have a healthy life? And if it's not sufficient, for all of your listeners who are in pharmaceuticals, you know, I will tell you there are plenty of examples where we've moved people around who might have been adapted for a certain kind of environment. So think about the amount of UV light there is in different parts of the planet. There are many people with vitamin D deficiencies, you know, quite frankly, because they don't get enough sunlight to manufacture enough vitamin D. And those individuals are at much higher risk for heart disease. And so knowing that you might have a person who, you know, from their great history genetically, was expecting more UV radiation in their daily life and suddenly has been put in a terrarium where there's not enough UV radiation for them to manufacture enough vitamin D to have a healthy immune and cardiovascular system, those individuals need supplements, right? They need a vastly different diet to make up for what the rest of their environment has missing. Right. So that changes the whole pharmaceutical industry in important ways, right? Then the pharmaceutical industry potentially is complementary to these mismatch situations.
That's fascinating. I always immediately think back to the pharmacist who's committed to their community and patient health and injecting the suggestion for stress relief tied back to green and gardening and trees and walking. And just got done talking with Dr. Ashley Dwyer, who works with clients, mostly professionals, and trying to de-stress their lives and help them to leverage exercise and nutrition. And one of the suggestions for our chain pharmacists, who've got to be some of the most stressed out healthcare providers out there, is, you know, every once in a while to get out and take a walk, you know, to give yourself off that 10 to 15 minutes of just being outside and, you know, getting away from that busy processing of 800 to 1200 prescriptions in a day. And it makes me think of you and your department. So this is quite amazing.
Yeah, no, I mean, we, in some ways I like to, when I talk to my kids about what I do, I like to say we're trying to return to, you know, kind of a more fundamental wisdom that I think we used to have, you know, which was, you know, that we should expect to be, you know, kind of good, you know, creatures on this planet, right? So we, you know, we should know how much water to drink because we drink when we're thirsty. We should know how to breathe. We should, I mean, the number of books I've read about what you would just take as common sense, you know, unfortunately is not common sense anymore. Right. There's a wonderful book on sleep, you know, written by that nice gentleman out at Stanford. I mean, you know, the fact that we have to remind people to sleep enough is a little bit crazy, right? And the fact that we have to remind people, you know, how to breathe, you know, is also a little frightening, right? Because I mean, these are things that I think we suddenly got too busy to be human. And then we got too busy to care about our connection to the rest of the ecology. And unfortunately, you know, I think we ultimately will pay the price for the disconnecting of the cords, if you will.
Several of your projects are requiring sensory data and data collection, and not only, you know, the collection of the data, but then using the data to point to things that are impacting health, such as noise pollution and pollution overall, and some of the biometric data that you're getting back. Can you expand upon that a bit? Because that also has been fascinating to read about.
Yeah. So the you know, when I speak with great envy about our friends in genomics and all the omics fields, they have very, very fancy tools, very expensive tools, and a very you know, kind of robust understanding of their domain, right? When you do a full genome-wide scan, or you do the transcriptome, right? Like how your genes express themselves and make proteins and all those wonderful things. That is so complex and elegant. When you turn to the environment and you say, show me the magic tools, right? Show me the tricorder, right? For the environment, we don't have one. Mm-hmm. And so it turns out we can't make progress unless we can sequence the environment, right? So what would it mean to sequence the environment? It would mean you would have sensors that could characterize all these things. How much noise is there all the time? How much air pollution is there all the time? How much sunlight is there? You know, like all of these things are infinitely easy to detect. I mean, we know how to detect them, but we've never brought it all together in any meaningful way, so that it could help us on our health journey. Because, you know, I can't take it a piece at a time, right? I know lots of people that have air monitors hanging outside their homes. And I mean, that's just unfortunately one just tiny little piece, right? And you know, like a lot of the diseases that we're talking about, they develop over lifetimes, and your exposures you accumulate over a lifetime. You know, very rarely are you in a situation where if I just had one little piece of information, one snapshot, I'd figure it out. You know, we're talking about diseases that they take a lifetime to develop, and, you know, their mechanisms evolve over time. And so we need to take the long view with the environment and the way that it works in our life. And we need to build the tools. So we, you know, we're aggressively always interested in new tools that sense the environment and there's a wide range of parameters in the environment. But you know, we'd really like to see the tricorder that essentially says, hey, you know, what were you exposed to in the last 5 years? Right. And I'd love to be able to sit down. I mean, if my doctor were trained to ask that question, what have you been exposed to in the last 5 years? I don't know. Maybe it would lead to a different treatment plan. Maybe it would lead to a different guidance, you know, for my diet or my exercise, right? But we aren't connecting these dots.
So, you know, the stimulation of our kids in technology, I'm old enough to remember before there was any video game, and I'm giving away my age by saying, you know, my first one was Pong. And I remember the day that there was no such thing as a video game. And I experienced something just 2 weeks ago with my 8 and 10 year old. And we did a whole bunch of activities. I took some time off. We went to Ohio Pile, which is a kind of like a nature.
The only white water you can find near Pittsburgh.
Exactly. Exactly. You know exactly what I'm talking about. And it's lots of nature and white water and trees and walking paths. And one of the section was the home or the nature made water slides that you kind of have to push yourself through. And it's a bunch of very fast moving water that cut out the rock. And now, of course, there's different pools that people go into and soak in and kind of play around in. And I asked at the end of this week period, from going to the Columbus Zoo and looking at the water slides there and going to this nature, what their favorite part of the vacation was. And they said Ohio Pile. And I'm like, it was free. We went, it was free. And that was their most favorite part. And I think there's something in our spirits. I think there's something inside humans that we're drawn to these environments. And even though both of my daughters live in what I would call, you know, urban and country environments, they still were very much drawn to that. And when I read more about you and your background and what you're studying through the Center of Health and Air and Water and Soil, you know, specifically, and the grant that you're getting in order to expand this research, I can't think of a reason not to incorporate this into our big data studies and our outcomes and our way of treating and stress, you know, de-stressing yourself by being around it. And it makes me excited for science, but it's also making me excited to be in pharmacy and to suggest some of this to our patients, because there's lots of consultancy now coming out of pharmacy, especially in the senior care space and institutional space, where a pharmacist has direct access to the patient follow-up from the therapies that have been suggested and have been prescribed by our physician to have influence to other things like diet and surrounding. So I'm going to not only talk about this, but we got to get this episode out to more pharmacists and then encourage your team to do a follow-up and participate in really expanding these ways of thinking.
Well, I will tell you, we need the pharmacy community desperately in this work. And it is because, you know, there's tremendous power in the synergy, right? In the co-prescription of things, right? So, you know, conjoint therapy that is, you know, maybe I'm at risk for hypertension. There is probably a pharmacological agent that will be helpful. And there may be some environmental circumstance that amplifies the effectiveness of that pharmacological intervention. And every day we're not working together, you know, and some of that's research, right, to develop these therapies conjointly, right, understand them conjointly. And, you know, some of that's just asking the question, right? I mean, we all understood grapefruit and statins, right? And that was a chemistry experiment. You know, take any medication that's ever been prescribed, and I think we haven't really sat back and thought about what is the relationship between sleep and this medication, really. And if we don't know the answer, instead of saying, we don't know, I mean, I hope somebody was just write it down, like, hey, we don't know the relationship between sleep and this hypertensive medication. And maybe someday somebody wants to go chase that, right? And if we really sort of worked on these things, I think we could have remarkably more effective pharmaceutical interventions, remarkably more effective, right? Because we'd be taking advantage of things that facilitate or inhibit the way they work. And they would be tools in the arsenal of the pharmacist, right?
I think of the data that's being collected by the EHRs in, you know, hundreds of thousands of primary care offices. And going back to before we started recording, your comment about knowing more about my health via my zip code and how that zip code could be an identifier of longevity and in basic health. I think that's fascinating. Share that with our listeners before we wrap up.
Sure. So, you know, recently there's been a real interest, especially from the health insurance industry, on understanding the what we call the social determinants of health, right? And so we come to this recognition that your health is much more than the little bit of time you spend interacting with the healthcare delivery system, right? The little bit of time you spend with your doctor, a little bit of time you spend, you know, getting a test or whatever it is. But we know that the rest of your time is somehow having an outsized appropriate influence on your health outcomes. So we know, for example, that people that don't have stable housing or people that don't have reliable transportation or have access to healthy foods, we know that those people don't do well, you know, from a health perspective. So we've seen that work pushed into, if I knew your zip code, I could probably take a pretty good guess about the kinds of diseases that you that will burden this community, just based on some of these parameters. So people will use the throwaway line, your zip code is a better predictor of your future health status than your genetic code. And that's absolutely true. If I had your 23andMe profile and I had your zip code, I promise you, I wouldn't look at your 23andMe profile at all. I would only look at your zip code, and I would be able to start to hack away at some parameters that might be important to improving your health.
That's fascinating. There's a PubMed article that I'm going to put in our show notes that references in various cities across America, the average life expectancy in certain communities are 20 to 30 years shorter than ones not even 10 to 20 miles away from the others. And that just blows me away. Something I never thought of about, never really realized, and is something that we have to pay attention to for this so-called buzzword population health, which is becoming so much more popular. Just did a podcast that we released about a week ago with an expert kind of trying to give a predictive analytics in the world of how Walmart's getting into bigger spans of healthcare in certain areas. And boy, the very first thing I think of is placing those kinds of hypermarket environments where your dentist, your eye care, your primary care, your pharmacist, and even your labs are all within that same area. But forgetting about your zip code and your environment and the green around you and the encouragement to engage with activities like gardening, I think that's going to play a huge role in longevity and then just living better so you're less stressed.
Well, I will tell you, just we'll wrap on this, you know, with this pandemic that we're all surviving through, you know, we'll have a good opportunity. I mean, I see people walking around all the time. They're spending more time in nature, your trip to Ohio Pile. You know, I think we're going to see some of this immune function on display here. I mean, there are unprecedented times where people are really spending much more time outdoors, much more time, you know, in places that they never would have spent time in. And then we're going to take a look at who was ultimately susceptible, who succumbed to an infectious disease. And I wonder if we'll find that there are different immune profiles that have evolved over the way people chose to deal with this pandemic.
Well, you're giving a reference to a podcast I'd very much like to do with you in follow-up, which is the Co-Immunity Project. So Let's do it.
We'll put a pen in it and we'll do it.
Exactly. Put a pen in it and we'll be right back with it. But I want to thank you, Dr. Ted Smith, for this time and sharing with our listeners your work. I'm going to have show notes, a little information about Dr. Smith and Evirome, you know, in your project and the institution. And and just get this out to as many people as we can. If you're listening, please share this podcast. This is amazing findings and something that I think there's lots of pharmacists out there that can tap into, especially our community pharmacists who have access. They're seeing their patients 10 times more than their primary care physician. And I think this is an important part of health. So thank you.
All right.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Listen to the podcast. Listen to the podcast. Listen to the podcast.